future plans for either parks or BES to acquire land in those areas as natural areas or as floodplain mitigation or as something else?
There are acquisition programs and parks target areas that the city has. We have to be careful about not linking that to zoning changes because of legal issues of affecting value. But there are programs like that that affect floodplains and some parks target areas.
And you might want to, just to understand the area that Commissioner Fish is talking about, it's perhaps easier to look at map number one in the bottom corner, because you can see the sort of the light green color there is the area we would be proposing to down designate. And then the darker green are open space areas, so you can see the relationship there. Okay.
We're happy to drop by your office and show you more detail on that, if that helps.
You know, we get periodically approached by landowners in that catchment area that you've identified that are interested in selling for the purpose of preserving that land as open space. And there's a just enormous number of challenges in that area. And I think I'd be interested as a follow-up just to see how does this proposed action dovetail with what the Parks Bureau and BES are projecting over the next 25 years in terms of acquisition and investment in that area.
Okay. Let's see. I think where I left off, of the proponents for these changes, there was support noting the stormwater runoff and the loss of tree canopy, landslide, stream erosion. And the opponents generally did express concerns about property value and intention of developing at some point in the future and losing that potential. We did get actual testimony to the Planning and Sustainability Commission from several of your bureaus, Environmental Services, Office of Emergency Management, Fire and Rescue, and the Urban Forestry Commission all expressed support for this set of proposals in testimony. And we also heard from Powellhurst-Gilbert Neighborhood Association and Linton Neighborhood Association expressing support. Staff did a tremendous amount of work to not only develop the proposal, but to talk to property owners, to look at properties, and to listen and review testimony. And as a result of that review, staff did recommend a number of changes to the original proposal. An example would be where we learned that recent infrastructure investments had been made, that for that we adapted the proposal a bit. We also learned in one situation, for example, there was a local improvement district that had already been completed, and in developing that LID, there had been assumptions made that on which the assessments were based on the development potential. So it was too late at that point to reverse that. So in that case, we made a modification. And we also did a number of boundary tweaks just to remove clusters of non-dividable lots from the proposal. So once we made those adjustments to the proposals and presented it back to the Planning and Sustainability Commission, the commission endorsed the proposal without any changes. Another feature of, again, still showing on the map called risks and service gaps, number four, a second grouping were residential changes that we proposed that are related to poor connectivity and a lack of infrastructure. And these are areas that are outside of centers and corridors, again, and they lack street and sidewalk connections, developed parks, basic services and amenities. And in particular, in the David Douglas School District, the infrastructure and service deficiencies are compounded by seriously overcrowded schools that would be further strained by additional residential densities that are allowed today. So the changes I'm talking about now are located primarily in the Powellhurst-Gilbert neighborhood in East Portland. And on this blue map, the blue doesn't differentiate between the two, but I can point to this area in East Portland, not the areas immediately around Pal Butte, but the other areas in East Portland are in the category I'm talking about now. When this area was originally developed as a low-density and semi-rural neighborhood prior to annexation to Portland, the lack of streets and sidewalks and other urban-level services was not an issue, but as apartment buildings have been built on large lots that had previously been developed with single-family homes, the population has increased significantly on many blocks without that corresponding increase in streets and pathways and other kinds of services and amenities that we need in a healthy, connected neighborhood. City staff has been hearing for decades, at least a decade, from individuals and quite a bit from the East Portland Action Plan stakeholders about the rapid growth that has occurred in this area in the 1990s and the 2000s. And again, the growth occurred, but without the corresponding increase in amenities and services to meet the needs of all those new residents. In our draft growth scenario report, we found that under the existing comprehensive plan densities in this area, East Portland has the hypothetical potential to gain an additional 20 to 42,000 additional households. And again, this growth is of particular concern to David Douglas School District because of their enrollment that's severely strained. So while over the last decade very little growth has occurred in East Portland, if the growth trends from the 90s and the pre-recession years were to resume, East Portland could gain additional individuals and families in poverty at a rate that's higher than any other Portland neighborhoods. So these are the issues that sort of prompted staff to take a look at the comprehensive plan designations in this area. Again, I wanted to refer to some of the policy support for some of these down designations. The proposed changes respond to policies that direct growth to high opportunity areas that have access to active transportation, that have access to jobs, developed open spaces, and supportive services and amenities. And our policies also direct us to respond to the impact of school enrollment, to consider that as part of our planning, which we didn't earlier have policies that looked at school capacity as infrastructure. So our new policies say that is something we need to consider in the evaluation of development potential. Our policies also tell us that where we do have a lack of basic public facilities and services or amenities, and where we do see significant growth potential, we should invest there. We need to fill those gaps and reduce those disparities. And this is important because even with the proposed down designations that are in this proposal here, there still will be growth. And so we don't want to stop investing in East Portland. We need to step up our investment in East Portland to kind of catch up with some of the development that's already occurred there. Testimony to the Planning and Sustainability Commission on these proposals was positive. Palhurst-Gilbert neighborhood was very supportive. David Douglas School District expressed support, and many others as well. There was some opposition, again, from people for whom this would represent a loss of development capacity. So you might be hearing from individuals, again, to say they had expected some ability to develop, and the down designation would change that. We also heard testimony from stakeholders saying we didn't go far enough, and you may hear that from David Douglas School District and others that say, this is good, we'd like to see even more development potential reduced. So there's a little bit of tension there. We did exclude from these proposals the areas right along the corridors and centers. So we were looking here specifically at the areas that were more distant from centers and corridors.
The conundrum is we're simultaneously trying to increase transit frequency on those north-south streets, and so we don't want to down designate to the extent where we threaten that viability, and so we're walking a careful line there where primarily the down zoning that we proposed are those blocks that are a little bit farther away from the transit line.
And just to give you an example of the kinds of changes we're proposing, we looked in some areas where in the Outer Southeast Community Plan back in 1995, I believe, where we had upzoned from single-family residential to multifamily. So we'd gone from, let's say, R5 to R1 or R5 to R2, and those are some of the areas where we sort of peeled back that proposed density back to what it had been prior to the Outer Southeast Community Plan. So reverting back to single-family residential in areas that are where that is the pattern today.
And just for Commissioner Novick and Commissioner Fish, who weren't involved in the Outer Southeast plan or went in Portland then. From my perspective, it was a very broad brush. It was not this kind of lot-by-lot, careful, let's be strategic. It was Outer Southeast, let's just make it all R2. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but that was the effect without looking at the infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And the folks in Outer Southeast at that time didn't have the political savvy to be able to push back the way Southwest did when the same thing was proposed in Southwest. So to my mind, what you're proposing is what coulda, shoulda, woulda done back mm-hmm. in the early 90s, and an entirely, it's an appropriate correction.
Yeah. It's also, as I mentioned, having David Douglas School District be a very active participant in this planning process has been extremely positive, and we're partnering now on other things as well to make sure that we're working with the school district as they look for new school facilities, for example. We feel like we have a shared commitment to seeing that be a successful process. So we've got a partnership today that we didn't have. I wish we did have back in that earlier planning process. Okay, I'm going to now move to the fourth map.
Before you do, may
sure.
I just ask a question?
Yeah.
Relating to public health and safety and carrying capacity of particularly yeah. sewer systems. So I don't remember if it's in the current comprehensive plan, but certainly in the zoning code, there's a provision, and this is related to skinny lots. So skinny lots citywide and skinny lots, particularly in West Portland, the West Portland Park Neighborhood Association area, the West Portland Park Plat, where there was a LUBA decision saying that the sewer capacity was not such to allow development on the underlying ancient 2.5 plats, lots. So I'm wondering, first of all, is there any what direction is there in the comprehensive plan policies that enables us to keep that zoning code section? And second of all, did we take the opportunity of redoing the policies and looking at the maps to see if we wanted to expand that protection of no, you can't develop a 2.5 density even if you've got the underlying skinny lots to other areas of the city?
I think the policy basis is in your packet, there's a set of residential compatibility policies that are on page.
Yeah, it's page seven. It's handout seven.
Page seven.
Just
so
in
that
front of the maps.
Talks a little bit about scale and patterns. That's new. We also still have the appropriate public facilities policies that would be backing up the idea that you shouldn't allow growth where there's not adequate public facilities. So that's still strongly there. We're not proposing to remove that current provision. And I think the public facilities policies are solid enough to ensure that that's still there. The 25-foot wide lots in West Portland are not that common throughout the city. More of those 25-by-100s are in the flatter East Portland, but which have their own sort of issues. But we did also do a fresh system adequacy mapping process. So we have maps of where there are sewer and water and system constraints, and so we could look at how that relates to those places. And that was the basis of where we chose these down designations.
What did you look at the skinny lot areas citywide and look at maybe where they're not going to be down designated? Maybe they should be zoned 2.5.
We're looking at some of that with our zoning proposal right now, because many of those areas have the comp plan already there and not the zoning, and so we're reviewing all of those areas against adequacy of services and for that very question.
That process is already underway, and we've had three or four meetings that Joe's been running with a stakeholder advisory group and looking at all of the 2.5 lots and issues around where they should be, where they shouldn't, what should we be making changes to how we look at those.
So will those be coming?
They will come after this. They will not be a part of the actual code. They will be going to the Planning Commission by September.
And then there would be potentially further comprehensive plan map changes
yes.
in response to
yes.
that.
Okay. And I think you're going to see that consistently. You may find issues here where, okay, this sets the right direction, but you didn't change the zoning yet around a couple different issues. That's sort of what we're doing on purpose.
But specifically changing the comprehensive map designation might come later, too.
Right. Yeah.
In places where actually we don't want the 2.5s.
Right.
Okay, great. Thank you.
And I can fill you in a little bit more about some of this. Okay. So are we ready to move to the last layer, which is map number 5? We call this neighborhoods, parks, and open space, and this is a big miscellaneous category. It includes a number of things, and I'm going to focus on one in particular. I will mention most of the changes on this map are, or about half of them are, residential changes, which I'll get to in a minute. It also includes a number of new open space designations. On this map, everything's colored in orange. It doesn't differentiate between open space and residential, which I know is a little confusing. But again, if you go back to map number 1 where you see the colors, that's probably more instructive because it will show you in dark green anything that newly designated for open space. And these are all properties. The open space properties I'm referring to here are all publicly owned, either by the City of Portland or by Metro. They're all intended for or already in open space use. And we worked with Parks and Recreation and Metro just to identify which properties they wanted to redesignate to open space because they're not currently shown as open space. So those are the dark green areas on that map.
Did you get all of the properties that we bought from Portland Public Schools in the Francisconi years?
I don't know the answer. I know we worked closely with Parks. There were some properties that Parks and Recreation and that Metro owns that you would think might be open space, but for a variety of reasons, the two respective bureaus or agencies didn't want them to be designated for open space. So I can't say for certain, but we've gone through, you know, a detailed spreadsheet with Parks to make sure.
Could I get that, please?
Oh, of course.
Thank you.
Sure. Okay, so as I said, this is a broad category. It includes a number, something like, 15 different reasons why we've made certain proposals for residential changes. But I'm going to focus on one particular group for two reasons. One is because it's a group of changes that engendered the most testimony with the Planning and Sustainability Commission. I anticipate you will also hear a lot of testimony about this. And actually, the PSC's discussion was quite lively. So I'm going to focus on this. And this could be described as residential changes that we're proposing to what I call truing up the land use designation with the prevalent lot pattern. And what I mean by that is places where the existing lots, the existing platting pattern, is predominantly at a slightly lower density than what the designation says. So it's a little bit out of alignment. We also chose areas that were relatively distant from centers and corridors to be in this category, distant from frequent transit. And what we did is we ended up looking across the city. We wanted to do a very consistent scan of the city to make sure that we were looking at and treating like situations in like ways. And so in this category, the Planning and Sustainability Commission ended up endorsing changes in the following areas. And again, on map 5, the first are areas in Mount Scott Arleta and Brentwood Darlington. And I will ask Marty, thank you, to point to these areas in inner southeast. And so these areas are currently designated for R2.5, which, just to give you for reference, this is sort of a townhouse or row house zone. Normally, this is a zone that is applied near transit or in the periphery of centers and corridors. But in this case, you can see it's an area that is further from transit, further from services and amenities, had that designation, but the current lot pattern is almost consistently R5. In other words, one house on a 5,000 square foot lot. So what the paper maps show and what's actually built are not the same. And because of the distance from transit and services, we didn't feel that this was an area that was necessarily appropriate for that level of density. And more, also, one of the issues we looked at here is there are currently relatively modest homes, and upzoning to match the current designation would actually be likely to prompt some displacement of current modest affordable housing. So we didn't feel like that was consistent with our policy direction. So that's an area where we propose to down-designate from the R2.5 to R5 to match what's currently on the ground. The second area is just a small location in the Wilkes neighborhood. And it's a small subdivision called Summer Place, where the lots are developed with 5,000 square foot lots, but it's got an R3 designation, which typically is something like a garden apartments. So they were just, it's not developed that way. It's very consistently developed with R5. So we propose to down designate to match what's already there.
It's at 148th and Halsey, and it's completely developed with nice homes, so it's not going to be changing anytime in the near future anyway.
Exactly. It seems like it's density on paper, but not. It's too hypothetical. So we're going to just true it up and match. The third group here, and this is where the testimony comes in, is a number of places that have an R5 designation, but an R7 pattern. And we have neighborhoods in Reed, Portsmouth, Reed, as you know, near Reed College, Portsmouth and Kenton in North Portland, Brentwood, Darlington, again down in the inner southeast, and then numerous very small pockets in East Portland. And these are areas that are, again, designated for R5, 5,000 square foot lots in the comprehensive plan. They're zoned R7 or are predominantly platted at R7. You may be aware that the Eastmoreland neighborhood also proposed to down-designate their neighborhood from R5 to R7.
Pardon me?
And South Burlingame as well. And Concordia, actually, as well. This was heavily discussed by the Planning and Sustainability Commission, and a narrow majority of the PSC voted to retain Eastmoreland and South Burlingame's current designation and zoning. The neighborhood provided significant testimony, well-documented, supporting the request. I anticipate you'll be hearing from them as well. And again, South Burlingame and Concordia followed with very similar requests. And those also were not supported by the PSC. So I'm flagging this for you because I anticipate you'll be hearing as well. The PSC's majority decision about Eastmoreland, South Burlingame, and Concordia was primarily based on the conclusion that the problems that they were raising could be addressed more appropriately through zoning code changes rather than zoning map changes. So among several problems that the PSC heard expressed by concerned neighbors, one of those issues was about these underlying lot lines that we mentioned earlier, and the ability where those underlying lot lines are to create new lots that are smaller than what neighbors expect to see in that neighborhood. And we have heard these concerns loud and clear. They were raised well by the neighbors, and we continue to hear those. And so those now are being addressed through the residential infill project, which we have started and are working on now. So again, that's something where we're going to try and address those underlying lots through that project. Another reason, though, that was cited by the Planning and Sustainability Commission in their decision and their discussion about this was the mix of lot sizes. So I mentioned a number of other areas where we did, the PSC did endorse a change. In those areas, there was much more uniformity in the lotting pattern. Almost every single lot in each of those areas was at an R7 size, whereas in Eastmoreland and South Burlingame, there was much more of a mix of lot sizes, and that, again, was compelling to the PSC. And finally, there was a note by PSC members in some cases that the proximity of the new Bybee light rail station was close, not to the whole neighborhood, but to portions of that neighborhood, and that was a compelling factor. So with that, I think we are concluding what we have to present, and we're happy to answer questions or have more discussion.
Elaborate on, based on this presentation, where we are in the mapping process.
I was not there for that lively discussion. Teresa might be able to enlighten you on that one.
Yeah, regarding the East Moreland and the South Burlingame game. So it was very lively. We really did look at what was on the ground and feeling that by changing the designation, there would be also quite a few non-conforming homes there, and those people were not there to talk about it. And finally, just that the Residential Infill Committee will do some work that will, I think, really greatly aid in this area in terms of style, design, proximity, what's appropriate on those old underlying plats. So we did not just make the whole scale comp plan change.
What I saw happen with the commission was that we did a lot of mapping and showing very, very clear close-in maps of what are the lots in each area, you know, what percentage of these are actually over 5,000 square feet. And so it became, instead of an emotional argument, we really tried to make it down to just here, you know, here's the facts and look at it and compare them from one area to another. That doesn't mean that there aren't other reasons you might want to make these changes. But the commission decided they wanted to be very sort of straightforward. It also started as just a couple of neighborhoods wanted these changes, and that was where we stepped back, and Marty in particular, who was pointing at the map, said we need to go and look where any place that this might be true and treat these all sort of comparably. So that's what we did.
Okay, other questions, follow-up requests?
I have a question about next steps. Is that premature?
Not at all.
So, Susan, the sort of comp plan 101 that you've orchestrated to give us a foundation of information ahead of the public hearings, I think, has been really valuable. And you've salted these discussions with some of the fault lines and the big policy questions we're going to have to tackle on it. So I really appreciate that. What's less clear to me is what's the next phase, because I understand we're going to start some public hearings in November. Next Thursday. How do we manage this process, given that there's a tsunami of public concern coming our way, and yet these all break down into discrete categories? How do we manage that in a useful way? And the thing I guess I'm most concerned about is just having these hearings where, you know, 100 people show up and we hear 101 different discrete issues. And at some point, it becomes difficult for us to sort of discern the thematics and the patterns and it tests our capacity. So how do you envision this working?
I'll start and let Eric clean up here, which is, we've already realized we think we need another hearing, so we're probably going to have a fourth hearing because we want to make sure that we give ample opportunity for everyone to be able to provide comments. We also sort of had an off-Broadway show with the PSC in that they already went through this process, so we learned a lot about, you know, we did about all of the comments coming in and about staff then categorizing them for you so that when we come back after the hearings in work session and say, okay, now we're going to talk about, you know, industrial lands, or we're going to talk about this R5, R7 issue, or we're going to talk about, we'll break it down into sort of buckets of here are the key issues, and let you discuss those one by one, and perhaps at that time begin to, we hope, bring out your amendments that you want to make in those topic areas so you can begin to have that discussion. So we'll do it in the way, you know, I think we've done it before where we've brought new sort of spreadsheets, and we say, okay, here's, you know, eight potential amendments around this topic that either of you have all come in, and we'll also have meet one-on-one with you so you can discuss what kind of amendments do you want to make.
So can we assume in these initial public hearings that each citizen representing either an individual concern or perhaps a lobbyist on behalf of some broader concern, that each person testifying, you're going to be tracking that person, the concern they raised, and then we're going to get some document that follows the hearing that says, Joe Smith talked about this, one sentence, this is addressed in the plan, it isn't, or raised as a policy. Because I can envision that if we did it the normal way, and that is after a five-hour hearing, the mayor says, well, let's see what follow-up questions people have. That could take 5 hours. It'd be nice to know that there's
in this case, there needs to be a box score.
there's someone keeping track of all the major issues and that we're going to get something back saying, you know, this is a valid concern, this has been addressed, this raises a policy question. And I guess I'm wondering whether you're going to do that staff work for us, because otherwise I sense five members of the council are going to be spending an awful lot of time trying to stay current.
What we hope would be a little bit of a hybrid where you, at the end of each session or in those one-on-one follow-up meetings, flag sort of thematic concerns or issues that caught your ear so that we can zero in on providing a useful list to you. Keep in mind that the Planning Commission had over 3,000 individual comments, so you know, even reducing that to a spreadsheet becomes a little bit unmanageable at some point. So we're hoping to work with you to identify the themes in there so that we can reach into that list of testimony and say, well, here's the testimony that relates to that particular theme or that concern you heard. It'll be both. We will definitely help you provide lists of where we think that is covered or not, but also need your help to point us in the right direction.
But Susan, what about the stuff that's going to come before us where you could actually, following the testimony, say, hey, great point, and it's in the plan, or great point, and here's why we couldn't do it. Something that's contemporaneous, because the other thing that we have to be careful about is lots of people coming in with concerns and then leaving not feeling either heard or there's nothing like the magic in our hearings of someone finishing their testimony and having someone like you come forward and say, we heard you, we got it. And it's not where you think it is, it's in another section of the plan. How do we manage that?
So there's two ways that I think we did at least with the commission, which is we're taking notes on every person that comes up. And so we're going to have people, two staff people taking turns. Basically, this person, here's what they said, this person. You know, and it won't be, obviously it won't be word for word. It'll just be, and we'll have the tape, you know, if you wanted to go back and hear exactly what that person said. But we want to track generally what each person is commenting on. At the end of each work session, we specifically, if it was going to end at, 5 o'clock, at, 4:15, we said, okay, we're going to stop testimony now, and we're going to have time so each commissioner could go around and say, I heard this and this, and I'm concerned about this and that and the other thing, instead of just leaving it without any closure at the end of each session. And so I think we're going to want to do that. We're also going to have to think a lot about, you're going to just have a lot of testimony coming in and a lot of people coming and make decisions beforehand in terms of logistics of, if you get at the first session 150 people or whatever it is, do you want to tell them immediately that if you're past number whatever, come back at the next one, send your thing, because you are not physically going to be able to potentially do all the ones. So we're going to have some logistics around managing the expectations of the people who've taken the time to come and not, and so we're going to try and do that a little bit up front for people we know they're coming and say, we think this one's going to be really full, but this one maybe not, try to come to that one.
Let me just offer one suggestion, because I think in a way this is like a hearing, a work session, and even has some elements of how we do our budget forms in the community. Just speaking for me, and I don't, I know Commissioner Fritz has a deeper understanding of these issues, having served on the commission. I know the mayor has a longer history. For me, it's about how do I make sure I understand the issue that's framed? How do I understand how to take whatever concern is raised? And Mayor, one thing we might want to consider is having a staff table actually set up. So rather than you sitting back there furiously taking notes, have you as a panel of staff experts sitting there so that as things come up, if we can't contain ourselves, we can actually turn to you and you can say, good point, Commissioner Fritz, it's in the plan, and there's a follow-up here, or we missed that, or whatever, so that it's a work in progress and not just a sterile hearing.
And I like that very much. I think it's a good idea. The other thing we might want to do, I know we're working on scheduling a fourth hearing, but we might even want to have an overflow hearing, on the books for if we simply run out of time, at one or more of those. We might want to just have one in reserve. I don't know, sort of, hearing to be named later. I mean, it's just we may have so much testimony on individual.
So it might help if I go into the expected schedule, and this is all penciled because, of course, we may, depending on how much testimony we get. Right now, as we mentioned, we've got three firm hearings and a fourth that we're working on the logistics for that will occur between next week and the first week of January. And then we have a little bit of a pause scheduled because we need time to absorb what we've heard. We have two work sessions penciled in late January or early February to then come back and start digesting. And what we did with the Planning Commission, which I think we would do again, is during that pause, we work with you to identify the themes of what resonated with you, you know, building off of the conclusion of each hearing, and use that to sort the comments we got into bundles and develop amendment packages that are in thematic bundles that we can then bring back to you to discuss in a coherent way, so that you're not just, you know, one-off property discussion, that we're able to bundle similar things together and talk about them as a group. And then we would set an agenda in those work sessions based on those groups and work through that with you. And again, it's all the sequence here is more important than the specific number of dates, because we may find we need more or less as we go. But that's the general sequence. Is we have initial hearings, we have a little bit of a pause, we have work sessions, and then you may want to have a final hearing on your amendment packages as well, and we anticipate that. So that could take us through the beginning of March, essentially.
So I'd like to have a follow-up discussion on the logistics of the hearing, perhaps with you, Mayor. When you mentioned we'd stop at a certain time and have council discussion, my preference would be to just continue to hear as many citizens as we can, because we can always have the discussion at a separate time where we don't take citizen testimony. We might also want to think about doing it the way we do it in the budget sessions, where people take a number and it's not who can afford to be there 2 hours early or send their lobbyists to be there to sign up first. Rather, it's folks take a number, and then it's, you know, it's bad luck if you don't get a turn to speak, but you don't feel quite as bad as if you were the one person just after the cutoff, which tends to engender a lot of bad feelings.
We do have every 2 weeks, and we're going to continue to manage this way, check in with your staff on Thursday mornings, and where we are scheduling that for these kind of logistical discussions, so we can. Now that the hearing's coming up, we anticipate that next meeting will probably be, which I believe is this Thursday, we'll start to dive into that.
Could I just ask an actual question that wasn't covered? You mentioned about testimony, starting to get a lot of comments about Multnomah Boulevard. Can you tell us what's the issue there and what we expect to hear?
I think it's actually just more about Multnomah Village, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, the question that has come up in Multnomah is we've proposed designating it as a neighborhood center, which is, as I described, the more village-like, smaller-scale centers. We've had a lot of testimony that it not be designated a center from the Neighborhood Association, and there's been some letters coming in that echo that, the wording of that comment.
So what's the difference between a center and a corridor, which I believe is what it is now, right?
Yeah.
On Main Street?
Currently, the comp plan has no designations like this. So there's no current Main Street or corridor designation in the current city comprehensive plan. There are Metro 2040 designations that exist, and this is, and Multnomah is a Main Street on that. Our intention with the neighborhood centers is that those represent our local implementation of the Main Street concept in the 2040 plan. So we believe what we've proposed in Multnomah is status quo. What is being requested represents further down designation in staff's view.
And was that considered at the Planning Commission, and what was your rationale for going with what you're proposing?
Yeah, we had quite a bit of testimony on that, and I believe our rationale was there is currently a town center. There are, or what, a corridor, whatever term you want to use. But anyway, there are commercial buildings, services, community center. So all of the makings of what we're looking at for that designation there. And I think the primary issue was they did not want to have any mixed-use development. They did not want to have taller buildings with residential living above. They wanted to keep the size and scale of it the same.
Right. And so why did you go with what you went with?
We went with the designation because of the current infrastructure that's there and the fact that that area doesn't have very much to pick from in terms of, oh, well, there's a better spot 3 blocks away. Let's just make it that way. So the Multnomah Village seemed to have the characteristics of the neighborhood center. I'm sorry, I don't have the designations right.
The part of the rationale goes back to our original metric of trying to make sure that 80% of the city was within walking distance of a center. And if we remove a center from this part of town, it takes a big vacuum, a big chunk of the city out of that goal.
We'll just move it to the West Portland Town Center. We'll figure it out.
Well, yeah, we also proposed West Portland Town Center. So,
One argument that I've seen specifically raised, and this is like one op-ed in one of the local papers, I'm not sure how widespread an argument is that we're sort of at transit capacity in Multnomah Village, and TriMet has said nobody else could be able to ride a bus, so we shouldn't have more people there. So we should have, if somebody's making that argument, we should have some response to it. Personally, I want to have a grocery store I can walk to, so I want a little more development in my own neighborhood, but that's not a necessarily universal view.
It goes back to the, you know, which comes first in the new agreement that we've sort of signed with TriMet, saying we're going to do our part and provide the zoning to allow the capacity in places where we think the market's going to move anyway. And so that's what we looked at that spot. And that TriMet then says, if you get that many people there, we will provide the kind of service.
That's the reassurance that people need, I think. By the way, just as an exercise, I'd be interested in hearing here or subsequently, what are the top 3 things people are going to be most angry about that we'll be able to reassure them based on things that's already in the proposed plan? And what are the top 3 things people are most angry about that we can't reassure them unless we change the proposed plan?
Yeah, I've got a corollary of that, which is let's stipulate that we've gotten better at this as we've gone along, right? That, you know, from 40 years of land use planning and the pain and suffering of the Southwest Community Plan and the Outer Southeast Plan, and so on. So this is asking you to really speculate, so whether it's our Planning Commission members or Joe or you, Susan, or anyone. If you look back at those earlier planning efforts, you could say that there were some issues that we had some deafening silences on and that we missed. Like, we missed this capacity density issue in Outer Southeast. We missed that. We didn't see the disconnect, or it wasn't highlighted enough. We missed that Vancouver and Williams would be an extremely urban character corridor with the designations that we had in place. We missed that we were overzoned for commercial in places like Hayden Island and 122nd and 82nd, and there wasn't necessarily there's a constituency in Eastmoreland or South Burlingame to argue for their issue, but maybe there wasn't a constituency to argue that, boy, when we start building all those apartments on Division and R1, we're going to wish they had storefront retail instead of having apartments right down to the street. So I'm asking you to look around the corner a little bit, not necessarily right now, but over the next couple months, and try to discern, you know, where those potential issues without a constituency, because people haven't seen it yet. You know, it wasn't that... the neighborhood activists in Northeast weren't saying, boy, you better watch out what's going to happen on Vancouver and Williams. They didn't see it, right? And Southeast Uplift didn't see the streetscape that we would get of a mixture of apartments with drawn blinds and storefronts on Division or Belmont. So I'm looking for those issues where there's deafening silence, you know, but nevertheless, 10 years from now, somebody's going to say, damn, we missed that. Obviously, that's difficult to do. I mean, 2020 is always better in hindsight than foresight. So on the assumption that we've gotten better at this, and on the assumption that particularly you're in dialogue with other cities that are working on some of the same issues, you know, I think it would be really good for us to look for some of those sleepers.
I think the benefit that we have that, you know, 20 or 30 years ago is the level of technical detail that, you know, all of these mapping and zoning decisions come down to a big basis of fact, and we can do that a whole lot better and do layering of maps and look at environmental issues, look at potential displacement because where the market's rising at the same time that there are, you know, this coming together of people with lower incomes or other, you know, renters together and looking at different issues in a different way. That doesn't, and then at the same time, I think we are doing outreach in a different way that is absolutely honoring the neighborhood associations and going to them and working with them, but also looking that there are a whole lot of other people that don't take part in that and working with them. So and then the whole issue of equity and displacement, we didn't talk about it. We were uncomfortable with it, and now I think we've put it front and center and said, no, we got to talk about this. We, you know, 20 or 30 years ago, we might have just been starting to talk about the environmental issues as being, you know, as serious as and as important as the economic issues, and that was sort of the shift then. And now I think the shift is that, no, these are bigger issues that we're trying to reach. We got to say, these are clunky tools. Zoning is not the answer to displace it. We know all the stuff that Craig and everybody else is, you know, Kurt is working on. Those are the other issues, too, but we'll try and look in the crystal ball as much as we can.
This is really phenomenal work, and you just pointed out it's built on Mayor Potter's work with equity and inclusion, Mayor Adams with the Portland Plan, and now Mayor Hales with his focus on this. When I was looking at, we're going to have 2 hours to talk about the comprehensive plan map, it's like, yeah, right, and here it is. We've got 10 minutes to go, and it's been really clear. It's been obviously very carefully thought through, one step at a time. It's phenomenal. Just congratulations. Thank you, Mayor Hales. Indeed so. Indeed so. Thank you. I'm in planning wonk heaven right now.
just real quick, we will get back to you and take a poll sort of how you want to run, you know, these sessions, because we want to honor everybody who comes to these, to the things, but we also have at some point you're going to have to make decisions. One of the things they got to is we went to 2 minutes instead of 3 minutes, because, and once people got used to it, they went, oh, okay, I can say the same thing, I can just get to it, and that's really hard for people, but you might, and then doing it in a way then that we advertise that, put it on our website and big, you only get the 2 minutes now, so people know that's important.
Just on the logistics, I agreed with both Commissioner Fish and Commissioner Fritz, who kind of said opposite things. I mean, Commissioner Fish said that it should be somewhat interactive. Commissioner Fritz said we need to let everybody speak. And I'm kind of wondering, maybe we could rely on you to, like, sort of blow a horn when somebody brings something up to which you think that we have a quick answer that addresses their concerns, but use the horn sparingly.
Yeah,
I just want to say that
I don't think they're
one indicator of a really high quality legal mind is the ability to argue contradictory propositions. And I think Steve has just demonstrated once again why he is the lawyer's lawyer on this panel.
I don't think that Commissioner Fish and I were actually in conflict. I agree with his that we should interrupt occasionally to see clarifying questions. And also I agree with myself that we should continue keeping testimony till the end rather than saving a half hour at the end, which most people want to have their say before they want to hear what we have to say. So I would encourage you to talk to the city budget office as to how they've done their processes. Also, I was very impressed in the fossil fuel hearing last week with the chopsticks with streamers on them, which is far cheaper than T-shirts and easier to hand out at the hearing in terms of being, I'm on this person's side. So what sometimes happens in these hearings is that one person will come and sign up 10 people. And so if we do it in order, then we hear 10 people saying the same thing. And if we can have a process whereby please wave if you are here primarily to talk about that particular issue, that can help us to move through the issues so we get each one. And especially with the streamers, you could see even better than the jazz hands, you could see how many people were jazzed about various parts of the testimony.
I don't know if this would be helpful, but we could maybe after the first two hearings make sure that we have meetings scheduled with each of you or your key staff so that we can go and say after the first two hearings, what are your, you know, 4 or 40 questions that you have right now that you want answers to, so that we just keep doing that.
And clearly with all the hearings, our schedules are getting booked up, so that having those on, we can always say, no, I don't have anything, but otherwise it's not going to be possible.
Two things that happened at the Planning Commission that I think helped. One is we tried to provide maximum testimony time by not doing extensive staff presentations, and so we're just going to do a 2-minute, 3-minute thing at the very beginning. This is what we've just done. And then also, we did find it useful, even if it's only 10 minutes, to have each commissioner say what was the most important thing they heard tonight at the end, just so we get a sense of what things to look at. And if that might be a compromise, if not a half an hour, but just say one thing or something. 5 minutes, yeah.
Yeah, and that little 1 minute afterwards really validates people that are here, because if you resonate back their issue, they're like, oh, yeah, okay, they heard me.
Suggestions. Nick had another one, which is either with an easel or a whiteboard. We ought to be recording trends and issues that we want to highlight. So if we have a staff table and there's somebody there that's doing that, just so there's the audience, the people that are here to speak, can see, oh, they've heard us on that issue.
Yeah, can you do one? I forget what it's called, but one of those where the words have somebody entering that, and at the end of the hearing, just pop it up with the bubbles. That'd be fun.
Good. Well, this is another great one. Thank you very much. Great work. We'll see you next week.